Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Our first show on food and agriculture a couple weeks back had audio that startled me. People were discussing the food riots happening around the world in early 2008. There was a big one in nearby Haiti which brought down the government. Did I manage to forget these riots? Or did I fail to learn of them? Maybe they weren't given that much press coverage in the U.S. 2008 was an election year, and the run-up to the presidential nominating conventions was well underway by April. Why cover bread when you can cover circuses? People were rioting because they could no longer afford to buy food. They couldn't afford to buy food because the price of food had gone through the roof. Not that all that many rioters owned an actual roof. Why did the price of food, especially grain staples such as rice, corn, and wheat, why did it skyrocket? Raj Patel and Katerina Wahlberg were the speakers on our program, and they named a few factors. The Iraq War had driven up the price of petroleum, and corporate agriculture is very petroleum-intensive. Also, biofuels was a big fad, and a lot of corn was taken out of food production and turned into ethanol to power our SUVs. But Patel and Wahlberg suspected that financial speculation in commodities accounted for much of the price spike. They suspected that Wall Street was inflating a commodities futures bubble, just as they had inflated the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble. And they inflated the food bubble for the same reason they inflated the other two, so that they could make a killing by selling out just before the bubble burst. If many more people had to feel hunger, and many more had to die of starvation, well, all's fair in love, war, and big finance. Patel and Wahlberg inferred that financial speculation lay behind the price spike, but in April of 2008, they couldn't prove it. Guess what? It's since been proven, and one of the greatest culprits has been identified. Guess who? Would you believe Goldman Sachs? Yes, the very band of psychopathic plutocrats that control the U.S. Treasury and the executive branch. The same bunch that brought us record home foreclosures. The same bunch that wrecked the world economy. That Goldman Sachs. We'll hear at least a couple of voices on the recent, and for many people, still current, food crisis. First, commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking in April 2008, astutely discusses the crisis and its apparent causes. Then I'll read a good recent article by Alan Moss on how Goldman Sachs fattened its pockets by starving much of the world. Then William Engdahl takes us from the 1940s through today. In the 40s, the Rockefeller boys began creating the modern, corporate-controlled, vertically integrated global agriculture system, which fit in quite well with their Standard Oil, Chase Bank, Munitions Industries, and Monsanto. But let's start with Mumia in 2008.
Food wars. Like a shadowy echo out of history, angry throngs massed at the Big House in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. But this time, they were not clamoring for their freedom. Or, if they were, it was for freedom from hunger. Their protests shook the government and forced the Prime Minister to step down. Several years ago, we saw massive protests in Oaxaca, Mexico, against exorbitant hikes in the price of corn, the grain which is the basis for both tortillas and tacos. In Egypt, bread prices are so high that the army there has been called in to stifle dissent and to distribute bread. Wheat, corn, and other such grains are becoming so expensive that millions of people around the world are seriously threatened by hunger. The cause? In truth, there are many, but perhaps chief among them is speculation and anticipated demand for biofuels, or the use of grains to produce fuel to run cars. Many grains are held off the food markets to await better prices for biofuels. In other words, people are going hungry, facing starvation, so that other people can pump fuels into cars. If ever there was an encapsulated image of the mercenary nature of capitalism, it can be seen in this one example, feeding cars instead of feeding people. This is also a window into what we call globalism. There are five massive companies that control 85% of the world's grain trade and about half of the world's grain production. As huge multinationals, Will they utilize this power to feed the people of the world or to maximize profits? The answer is obvious. And even though kids in school aren't taught this truth, the fact of the matter is we all live closer to the age of gasoline than the age of the atom. For every item we purchase, from food to coats, from jewelry to DVDs, bears the cost of transportation in its price. And as the price of gas soars, that price is passed on to the consumer. So fuel exacts a kind of double tax when it comes to grains. Through speculation and transfer to biofuels, all such grain prices rise. To this is added the price of transport. The logic of the market leads to mass starvation. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
A friend sent me this interesting article just a few weeks ago. It's by Alan Moss. It's taken from socialistworker.org. It's dated August 5, 2010, and it's titled Banking on Hunger. I've condensed it a bit for radio. Last year, Rolling Stone journalist Matt Taibbi described megabank Goldman Sachs as, quote, a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money, unquote. It's an apt description. Goldman Sachs helped inflate the housing bubble of the 2000s in order to keep the Wall Street casino going strong. Then, when the bubble burst and pushed the world financial system to the brink of meltdown, Goldman aimed its blood funnel at the U.S. Treasury. The federal government returned the big banks to financial health with an immense infusion of money from U.S. taxpayers. Based on some newly revealed information, maybe Rolling Stone owes an apology to vampire squids for the insulting comparison. Earlier this year, Congress investigated a scam in which Goldman created a security that was designed to fail. Anyone who invested in it lost their money. Why was it designed to fail? So hedge fund boss John Paulson could place a financial bet that the security would fail. Paulson made a cool $1 billion on a sure thing, and Goldman pocketed big fees for setting it all up. And now, more details are emerging about a Goldman Sachs plot. Speculation on food commodities, which pushed food prices through the roof, sparking riots in dozens of countries, and causing untold misery in the rest. Goldman Sachs' contribution to the food crisis of 2007 to 2008 is a particularly ugly chapter in its ugly career. Starting at the end of 2006, world food prices began to rise. Fast. Between 2006 and 2008, average prices for rice rose by 217%, wheat by 136%, corn by 125%, and soybeans by 107%. According to The Economist magazine, the real price of food, adjusted for inflation, reached its highest level since 1845. The price increases had horrifying consequences around the world. According to journalist Frederick Kaufman, the food bubble of the mid-2000s pushed 250 million more people into the category of food insecure. This is almost the population of another United States. The world's hungry jumped past the 1 billion mark. Even in the U.S., food prices reached levels not seen in a generation. In 2008, the number of Americans vulnerable to hunger grew 49%, or about one in every six people in the country. And then food prices started falling again. By the end of 2008, they were close to their pre-crisis levels at the big commodities exchanges, though the prices that consumers paid didn't drop as fast. What happened? One man-made cause was rising oil prices, resulting from the U.S. war on Iraq. Another was the U.S. government's biofuel craze, which led agribusiness to take land away from other crops to grow corn for ethanol. But the most important cause of the food crisis of 2007 to 2008 was commodity speculation. Wall Street's biggest players saw an opportunity for profit by manipulating the price of food, and they took it, at the cost of people around the world going hungry. So to ask again, what happened? The short answer is, Goldman Sachs happened. Sidebar comment. Now, in this next section, Moss explains the actual mechanisms Goldman and others used to drive up the price of food. Here we go. For more than a century, agricultural producers have relied on a system where they sell crops or products that they promise to deliver in the future. In theory, this futures system protects farmers against the risk of a bad harvest or price decreases, and it assures businesses that buy agricultural goods of a steady supply. The introduction of futures trading at commodity exchanges opened up opportunities for speculators to bet on whether the price of contracts to deliver some product, wheat, corn, cattle, etc., would rise or fall before they came due. This was nothing more than gambling with people's livelihoods, but the damage that speculators could do was limited by the basic rules of future trading, that actual agricultural products ultimately had to change hands. Enter Goldman Sachs. In 1991, it launched the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, a measure of the price of 18 different commodities, and invited speculators to place their bets on whether it would go up or down. Other Wall Street firms then set up their own agricultural index funds. The stage was set for a speculative frenzy on agricultural commodities unlike anything seen in the past. It took another decade for the catastrophe to materialize because there are more lucrative opportunities for financial gambling. First, the tech bubble of the 1990s, then the housing bubble of the 2000s. Food's turn came in the mid-2000s. Big players like Goldman Sachs recognized that the mortgage and real estate markets were poised for a fall. The gamblers had to find a new table at the casino, and the agricultural commodity index funds looked good. In 2003, holdings in these funds totaled $13 billion. 5 years later, there was $317 billion invested in commodities index funds. Sidebar comment, that's an increase of more than 24 times, an increase of 2,400% in 5 years. Back to the text. The same logic that inflated the real estate bubble was now operating on food prices. With more and more speculators climbing into the market, prices shot upward. The price of wheat traded in the U.S. historically varied between $3 and $6 per bushel. On February 25, 2008, wheat futures hit $25 a bushel. As Frederick Kaufman summarized, bankers had taken control of the world's food. Money chased money, and a billion people went hungry. Sidebar comment. Now here's Moss's concluding section, in which he steps back and takes a look at the broader picture. Back to the text. Wall Street's responsibility for the food crisis is an extreme example, but the underlying logic of food production under capitalism, even in normal times, is no less obscene. Each year, around 6 million children under the age of 5 will die from malnutrition and related diseases. This isn't because the world doesn't grow enough food. Enough food is produced for everyone to get 2,800 calories a day, well above the minimum standards. But that 2,800 calories a day depends on the food produced being shared equally. It isn't. Food costs money, and that means the poor go without. As the Financial Times put it, people are not hungry because food supplies are not available. They are hungry because they are poor. In a capitalist system, food is treated like any other commodity, from cars to televisions to pharmaceuticals and healthcare. Instead of being organized to feed the hungry, the system is organized around not feeding everyone. The explosive rise in food prices in 2007-08 came as food supplies held steady and supplies of some grains, such as wheat, increased. There can be no greater indictment of the capitalist system than the fact that its masters view food not as something that all people must have, and that more than 1 billion people desperately need more of, but as a thing that can be bought and sold in order to acquire more riches. As Johann Hari concluded in The Independent, quote, "The world's wealthiest speculators set up a casino where the chips were the stomachs of hundreds of millions of innocent people. They gambled on increasing starvation and won. What does it say about our political and economic system that we can so casually inflict so much pain?" Unquote. And so, with that quote from Johann Hari, the excellent British journalist, With that ends Alan Moss's very interesting article, Banking on Hunger.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pajamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira. Now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing like a newly minted pound. Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that waits the world around. You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just a phase. For it's money, money, money makes the world go round.
So much for Goldman Sachs. Goldman is bad enough, but other financial types are also controlling every other aspect of the global food system for their own benefit. The Rockefeller brothers were both financiers and industrialists. They pretty much created the modern global food system, an industrialized system dominated by a handful of huge, vertically integrated corporations. Here, William Engdahl talks about agriculture and Rockefellers with Ken McDermott Rowe on Ken's show, History Counts.
Rockefeller brothers loom very large in your book. Could you talk about their role in the Green Revolution, the Gene Revolution, and putting together this global agribusiness and how it relates to their earlier oil business?
The Rockefellers reasoned, okay, just as you mentioned the quote from Kissinger, control the oil, you control nations, control food, you control the people. They thought this would be a wonderful extension of their power reach if they could develop an industrialized, vertically integrated food chain internationally. And furthermore, they had huge reserves of nitrates and so forth that were used to produce bombs during the war, DuPont, Dow Chemical, all these large chemical Hercules powder. And they were wondering what to do with all this nitrate. Some of their staff came up with the idea of using this for chemical fertilizer for agriculture. And then, of course, they had a lot of oil sloshing around that there weren't yet markets in Europe because Europe was in a devastated state. So they said, let's industrialize agriculture in select parts of Mexico and the developing world. India was a big target of theirs. And through that industrialization, we'll introduce our fertilizers, our gasoline for the tractors and so forth, and only the big, largest farmers will be able to afford these kinds of inputs. So we'll tend to create a farm system, an agriculture system, that will tend to be similar to the latifundista system, the old feudal system in Latin America. So that was really the Green Revolution. The gains in crop productivity in the end of the day after two or three harvest years turned out to be quite the opposite, and it made these countries dependent on imports of fertilizer, later on imports of seed, not GMO seeds, but that came later. But the deed had been done, and they were locked into the Rockefeller oil and fertilizer chemical industry.
So you noted other negative effects of the Green Revolution, the depopulation of the countryside.
Oh, it's devastating, yeah.
The increasing disparities of wealth, and also you have the introduction of large amounts of pesticides.
Yeah.
With the associated health problems.
And keep in mind, after 1945, four brothers had more power than any four human beings on the face of the earth, and they were Nelson, John D. III, Lawrence, and David Rockefeller. But those four brothers, the Rockefeller brothers, literally divided the world up after the war. John D. III took as population control his pet project and created the Population Council, birth control, all of these projects to reduce or control population growth. Nelson was the political figure. He went into the Eisenhower administration and later administrations to try to build the family's policies through government. And then David became the banker. He preferred to stay a little bit in the background and ended up being the most powerful of all the brothers.
And they essentially put together a giant cartel in which the oil company Standard Oil was a part of it, but then you also had chemical companies like Monsanto, DuPont, Dow Chemical, and then the grain distributors like Cargill and Archer Daniels. So
right.
Together it was a very concentrated industry.
Oh, it was extraordinarily powerful machine. You know, people talk about J.P. Morgan as the most powerful banker industrialist of American history, but he was really a minor player and literally played little or no influence after 1931, after the House of Morgan was split up by the Glass-Steagall Act in the Depression. And what emerged was the Rockefeller faction through their banking interests, Citigroup, Citibank at that time, and Chase Manhattan, or Chase Bank in the 50s. And then through the banking, that was kind of the linchpin of this whole industrial empire that went around the globe. What's important to realize that it also is heavily tied into Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, the largest defense contractors. So the Rockefeller Group had simultaneously a huge interest in big oil, in big chemicals, and the military and industry complex.
Now, going back to the 1930s, the Rockefellers had a strong interest in the new field of molecular biology. Could you talk about that and then how it relates to the development of the gene revolution and genetically modified organisms?
Sure. The hegemonic discipline of biology today is something called molecular biology. And it's the pet Rockefeller University and Rockefeller Foundation dream back to the 20s when they were so fascinated with the idea of eugenics, getting rid of the unpure or the inferior races and, you know, breeding the pure race through genetic manipulation. So their idea was, if we can just reduce life to a single gene, you know, the DNA, RNA, the genome project, and then if you find the key to fiddle around with that gene, you can create a master race, or you can create a race that will self-destruct and commit termination on itself. So Warren Weaver and others at the Rockefeller Foundation back in 1938 began giving large research grants to biologists at Cambridge University and physicists around the world to develop this theory. And because they were one of the few private institutes that had money for this kind of research, of course, hungry scientists, hungry biologists began writing up grant proposals to get Rockefeller money. And that became a self-perpetuating, so that by the 50s, by the 60s, by the 70s, this was the dominant school of biology. And you had to keep in mind, Nelson Rockefeller was inside the U.S. government for a brief time, heading up the grant process at Health, Education, and Welfare Department, so he could give grants to universities furthering this research in molecular biology rather than ecological biology.
Well, how does a GMO plant differ from an ordinary plant, and what advantage would the Rockefellers and their associates see in developing a GMO plants?
The difference is the following. You bombard a normal seed, let's say a seed of a certain variety of corn, with a foreign bacteria or foreign entity. You bombard it, and it's an incredibly crude process. It's hit and miss, fiddle stick or not stick, like throwing mud on the wall. Then if it sticks and you have a trait, then you try to reproduce that seed, and then you immediately patent it for certain traits. For example, you want it to be resistant to the European corn borer, an insect that eats corn crops. So they advertise this as seeds that will allow you to grow corn as a farmer, but have absolutely picture book green stalks on your corn and so forth, and the uniform height, there'll be no insect damage whatsoever. The other traits you can breed it for is that it's, the main one is that it's resistant to a herbicide, one of the most toxic herbicides known, and it's the most widely used herbicide. I bet many of your listeners use this without knowing in their home gardens. It's called Roundup, and it's patented and distributed by Monsanto. There's some people who say they think that Monsanto developed Roundup-ready soybeans, Roundup-ready corn, and so forth, the seeds that would be resistant to the toxic effects of their Roundup herbicide, in order that you have to buy the both as a package in order to grow your crops.
So you buy the seeds, you buy the Roundup herbicide.
Yeah, you have to buy the Roundup, otherwise you have a huge problem with weeds.
And I understand that most of the world's livestock is now fed with the GMO soybean.
Yeah, there are three countries which are overwhelmingly dominating the world soybean market, and those are the United States, Brazil, and Argentina. The first guinea pig project for mass production of soybeans back in the 90s was in Argentina under the regime of Carlos Menem, and Monsanto, under the table, managed to wrangle a sweetheart deal where they have exclusive rights to sell Monsanto-patented Roundup-ready soybean seeds, and Roundup, of course, in Argentina. So this all went on during the debt crisis, which Chase Manhattan Bank of David Rockefeller played a key role in manipulating this debt crisis. So under the crisis of debt, the IMF comes in, says devalue the Argentine peso massively so that you can export. And what are you going to export and earn dollars for? Well, soybeans. Soybeans are in big demand now for agriculture feed around the world and the European Union. China, there's a growing market for imported soybeans, etc. So that's exactly what happened. Argentina today, 97% of all their soybeans are genetically manipulated, and they're made by Monsanto. These seeds are patented by three or four giant agribusiness multinationals, and the overwhelming seeds of the world right now are in their hands. And three of those, Monsanto, DuPont, and Dow Chemical, their GMO offshoots, have decades-long intimate relation with Pentagon chemical warfare, secret chemical warfare programs like Agent Orange in Vietnam, the dioxin scandals and so forth, where Monsanto desperately tried to cover up the toxic effects of these chemicals on their own workers. They lied to the courts, they manipulated their test results and so forth. So these same companies are now telling us, trust us with the world seed heritage, trust us with the future food harvest of the world. We're a good citizen, we're a good player, and we'll take care of the world, don't worry. Well, I worry, and I'm not about to trust Monsanto with the future of my family's seed supply.
So you see, the situation is probably even worse than you imagined. Arrayed against the small farmer and the food consumer are all of the so-called masters of the universe. And if they want you to eat Monsanto Roundup-ready genetically modified soybeans, by gum, that is what's going to be in your tofu tonight. And you'll pay $4.50 a pound for it, or do without. Another conspiracy theory. Except this is no theory. This is well-documented historical facts. Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thanks to Mumia Abu-Jamal, Ken McDermott Rowe, William Engdahl, and Alan Moss for the material for today's show. I'll post links to the complete Engdahl interview and to Moss's complete article on the show's website, which remains newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, and ciao.